Good afternoon and welcome. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us. I appreciate it. In our increasingly polarized political environment, differences in political philosophy are often premised in complete mistrust and antipathy toward political opponents. Perhaps one of the biggest indicators of what divides us isn't party affiliation, but rather the chasm between rural Americans and those who live in metropolitan areas. The political scientist Tom Schaller, who teaches at UMBC, and former Washington Post columnist Paul Waldman have written a book that examines this divide. They argue that people who live in rural communities wield outsized political influence. Going even further, to the chagrin of their critics, Schaller and Waldman assert that, quote, white rural voters pose a growing threat to the world's oldest constitutional democracy. This is a serious and damning accusation, and while the book has been applauded for its telling-it-like-it-is frankness, it has also been attacked for its harsh characterization of a demographic that has been steadily moving away from the Democratic Party and which has given rise to the likes of Donald Trump and his many adherents. The book is called White Rural Rage, The Threat to American Democracy. Tom Schaller and Paul Waldman join me on Zoom to talk about it. Welcome to you both, gentlemen.
Welcome. Thank you.
Thank you, Tom.
So, Tom, let's start with you. What's your basic thesis here? Why are rural Americans a threat to democracy?
Well, let's start by backing up and asserting, as we believe, that Trump and the MAGA movement are the deeper and wider threat to our democracy. And we firmly believe that. I'm sure millions of Americans, including the 70 million plus who voted for him in 2020, disagree. But as we open the book, we say, since the rise of Donald Trump, people who never before worried about the fate and state of our democracy have suddenly begun to wonder about our existential survival. And at the same time, no group of Americans have gotten more attention than so-called downscale white voters, and especially rural white voters. And we say, these two phenomena have happened at the same time, but nobody has noticed that they're connected. And we do believe they are connected because rural white voters, though a small share of the national population, about 15%, are the most loyal and devout Trump supporters. They voted for him 62% in 2016, but voted 71% for him 4 years later after witnessing his presidency, a 9-point shift toward Trump at a time when the other 85% of the country moved about 3 points away from Trump and toward Biden. That is a 12-point difference in the response to a president who repeatedly made racist, xenophobic, anti-democratic sentiments, engaged in conspiracism, and frankly, either justified or even called for, in some cases, violence. And we think he's a danger to the republic. And we find it ironic that one is not allowed to, as we've heard from our critics, point this out about the most loyal and devout Trump supporters. And so that's why we wrote the book. We noticed that rural whites were almost always at the top or the bottom of various polls, least likely to support gay rights, most likely to say the president should act unilaterally without checks from Congress and the courts, least likely to believe elections are legitimate, most likely to believe in QAnon conspiracies. It's not every poll, and their sentiments are not limited to rural white Americans, and they don't apply to all rural white Americans. But there is a serious problem here. We identified it. People don't like it, but it needed to be said, especially at this moment, in our view, this very fragile moment for our democracy.
And Paul Waldman, when it comes to your contention, and you say this right in the beginning of the book, as Tom was just referring to, that there are polls and studies that show that rural whites have the lowest levels of support for longstanding and essential democratic principles. Is the correlation between, was it Trump first and then these low levels of essential of support for longstanding and essential principles happen? Or did those, did the waning or the attenuation of support for those principles precede Trump, and did Trump tap into it? Where's the chicken and the egg here?
There is some evidence that it preceded Trump, and that's true of a lot of different characteristics of rural politics, that Trump only kind of reinforced and exacerbated a lot of the issues and the problems that were already there. And so there is some evidence that kind of waning commitment to some democratic norms had existed before. But then Trump comes along and tells people that you shouldn't accept the results of any election that doesn't go your way, that the checks and balances of our democratic system that have existed for 250 years are just a kind of a problematic impediment to you and people like you, and that all the resentments that you feel and the hatreds that you have of people who are not like you are not only justified, but they ought to be nurtured, and you ought to express them in ever louder ways, and that is the way you ought to engage in the political world is through anger and resentment and hatred. And again, not everyone in rural America responded to that message, but increasing numbers of people did. And it's because rural areas have this kind of extra political leverage that they were able to help send him to the White House. Without that kind of exaggerated support in rural areas, Trump would not have been president in 2016. And if he wins this year, it will be on a foundation of his rural support, which, as Tom said, went to 71% in among rural whites in 2020, and it could be even higher this time around. We'll have to see. But people are familiar with some of the ways that that rural areas are given that kind of extra political weight. Everyone knows about the Electoral College, which gives extra weight to small states. You know, the Wyoming, 58,000 people who 580,000 people who live in Wyoming have the same representation in the Senate, and therefore this elevated representation in the Electoral College. They have the same representation in the Senate as the 39 million people who live in California. And so small states have this kind of extra boost in both the Senate and the Electoral College. And then there are ways within states that Republicans have successfully drawn district lines and changed other rules to give kind of an enhanced power to rural areas. And that helps them then make it so that Republicans can hold on to power even in places where they have only a little bit of an advantage. You see this in a number of different states like Texas, for instance, where it's becoming increasingly purple. Trump beat Biden there by only 6 points, which is much less than we've seen in previous presidential elections. But Republicans have an ironclad lock on the state legislature because of the way they've drawn district lines in order to enhance the power of rural voters at the ballot box. And so they have this kind of outsized influence. And everything about the politics that they receive now, whether it's from Trump or from other politicians who represent them or from conservative media, all push them to view politics through this very kind of angry lens of us versus them. And whatever problems they have, and the problems in rural areas are profound, they should be blamed not on the people who they keep electing, but on Hollywood liberals and coastal elitists and immigrants and a whole set of targets who are not actually responsible for the things that are going on in rural America.
And Tom Schaller, you say at one point that rural white Americans' attitude might be best described as, I love my country, but not our country. That seemed to be redolent of Sarah Palin back in 2008, you know, the real America that she talked about all the times. Trump phrased it, stealing from Ronald Reagan, make America great again. What do you think, what do you mean by characterizing, you know, the distinction between my country and our country?
Well, I think it's interesting that you mentioned Sarah Palin, because in some respects she's sort of Trump, you know, the beta version or version 1.0. And, you know, she ran on the bottom of the ticket, of course, with McCain in 2008, whereas Trump, a man, which doesn't hurt, ran at the top of the ticket. And I think he borrowed a lot of this sort of folksy real America, clothing and wore it in a way that endeared him to citizens, not just in rural America, but across America, which is ironic given that, you know, he's always in a suit and a tie. He doesn't dress up in, you know, Carhartt jackets or wear a camouflage hat when he goes to more sparsely populated corners of the country. He is who he is, and he sells anger and resentment and is, in fact, pitching himself for re-election as retribution, which, of course, getting retribution against other people doesn't solve your own problems. There's the infamous quote of the woman who said at a Trump rally that Trump isn't hurting the people he's supposed to be hurting, which is, in some senses, a reflection of this taste, this demand for retribution. As for, you know, our country versus my country, I think it's very clear in the movement for Great Replacement. I think in the reaction to Black Lives Matter, which of course means Black Lives also matter, or Black Lives Matter too. They probably could have named their organization better. You know, and you hear people say, well, White Lives Matter too, and Black Lives Matter isn't claiming that they don't. When you see the response to diversity and inclusive and equity programs on campuses that we're seeing from governors, pushing back on state legislatures and pushing back on state university systems in terms of having DEI programs or initiatives, there is a clear demographic change happening in the country. We believe Ezra Klein is right in his book, Why We're Polarized, in Chapter 5, where he identifies the demographic change as the single biggest force that's balkanizing our country into red and blue America. And for people who are white generally, not just rural, but especially white and rural, they seem to recognize, and fairly, let's be clear, in a numerical standpoint, that their country and the people who look and think and act and pray like them are disappearing as a share of the population. We were a majority rural country until 1920. Now we're down to about 20%. And 15 of that 20%, or about three quarters, are white. They are a declining share of the population with each new census update every year and every new census report every decade. And so, look, again, it's not limited to white rural Americans. There are plenty of Trump supporters in the suburbs and even cities who fear that, you know, a white America, a white Christian America, is getting away from them. And so that phrase, I love my America, but not our America, reflects this idea that there is an America that's disappearing, that they love and they want to be restored. Remember, the most important, the most operative word in the MAGA acronym is the last word. Again, make America great again. It harkens back to an America where political power and the American dream didn't have to be shared with women, no less people of color, and no less people who are gay. And in our view, a truly inclusive and pluralistic and secular America is the true constitutional America. And that America is fast approaching. Some people are welcoming it with open arms, and other people have their arms folded against their chest.
And Paul Waldman, you talk about the conditionality of the patriotism of rural America. You say that, as Tom was just mentioning, that they're uniquely xenophobic towards people who don't look like white Americans. They are the least tethered to reality, likely to subscribe to QAnon conspiracies, that sort of stuff, less supportive of principles like free speech and free press and separation of church and state, and even that they were more inclined to use force. Now, your critics will say that the studies and the polls that you're using to make those claims, the sample sizes aren't big enough and you're misinterpreting some of the data. Let me ask you to respond to that, as well as why it is that rural white citizens are the least tethered to reality in your formulation of all the demographic blocks we have in the country.
Yeah, and it's important to reiterate that these kinds of things don't apply to everybody in rural America. There is diversity in rural America, and they apply to people who live in cities and suburbs also. So none of this stuff is exclusive to rural America or universal in rural America. And that is important to keep in mind. But it's also true that in case after case, what you see when you look at these poll results is that rural whites especially are the outlier. And so they are disproportionately a share of people who may hold some objectionable views. And that's important to keep in mind, because I think that there's been a lot of people who sort of have kind of taken what they think we have said and taken it to an extreme. So, you know, there was a study that tested people's view of January 6th and divided them into, you know, people who were who the author called insurrectionists, which basically meant that they were supportive of the January 6th insurrection. And we cited that in our book. And there was an article where the author got quoted and he said, no, they, most people who have that view are not of real America. Well, that's true. But in his own work, it turned out that 30% of people who expressed that support for January 6th were rural Americans. And if rural whites are only 15% of the country, well, that means that they are very much disproportionately supportive of what happened on January 6th. And that's the danger. You know, if they were just kind of a meaningless group that you could, you know, slice and dice the way you do 100 other demographic groups, you know, whatever it is, you know, left-handed women who live in towns above 5,000 foot elevation, then it wouldn't be very significant if they did, even if they did have some views that were troubling or they were the outliers. But because they hold such an important place, especially in the Republican coalition, that means that when they do take views that are outside of what everyone else believes or views that are troubling in some ways, it has a greater kind of political impact. And we see it in the way that they're treated. You know, after 2016, every news organization sent reporters to go to, you know, every diner they could find in the heartland where they could see some, you know, red hat wearing Trump supporters and interview them and take very seriously their grievances without any kind of moral judgment. And there's this kind of solicitousness toward them that we think is reflected in the way that some scholars of rural politics treat their own results, that when they find something that's a little disturbing, let's say it's opinions, the higher prevalence of racial resentment among rural whites compared to urban and suburban whites, which a number of different scholars have found, they tend to downplay it. They try to sort of explain it away, say, well, it's not that important. But if they are really at the core of the support of one of our two parties, then it actually is significant. And this is a way that America differs from other countries that's important to realize too. If you look around the world, everywhere where there is a right-wing populist movement, you almost always find that it gets its highest support in rural areas. That's true in places like France and Germany. The difference in America is that rural people have this kind of outsized political power at the ballot box. And that's what makes it significant. And that doesn't mean necessarily that they're getting the things that they want. And this is an important distinction, too, that we can talk about in greater length. But there's a lot of criticism of Democrats, some of it justified, for not spending enough time in rural areas, talking to rural people, going back there and trying to win their votes, even if they're going to lose most of them. But nobody ever seems to criticize Republicans for not only not delivering any kind of meaningful change to address the very profound problems that rural America faces, but also for just continuing to play to the worst instincts of rural people, their most profound resentments, the things that are least likely to actually produce that kind of meaningful change. And Trump is the apotheosis of that, but he is far from alone. There are all kinds of politicians who tell their rural voters that all you need to do is be mad. And that should be the sum total of how you engage with the political world. And don't ask me whether I've done anything to improve your healthcare access or the state of your schools or the economic opportunities that you have. That's not my job as your member of the state house or your congressman. All I'm here for is to make you mad at those people you hate.
And we'll talk forgive me for interrupting, but we got to take a quick break and we will talk about some of the reasons for that anger when we do come back. That's Paul Waldman along with Tom Schaller. They're the authors of White Rural Rage, The Threat to American Democracy. By the way, we reached out to two critics of the book, Nicholas Jacobs, who's a scholar at Colby College in Maine, who studies rural America, wasn't available to join us, and another scholar, a guy named Tyler Austin Harper, he's also from Maine, has not yet responded. We'll have more on White Rural Rage with the authors of the book on the other side of a quick break. I'm Tom Hall. It's Midday. Stay with us.
This is 88.1 WIPR.
Thank Thanks, Andy, and welcome back. It is Midday. I'm Tom Hall. And coming up tomorrow on our show, our series of conversations with the candidates continues with April Delaney. She's a candidate for the House of Representatives in the 6th District primary. She's one of 16 Democrats in the race to succeed David Trone in Congress. That's a seat that her husband, April Delaney's husband, John, held for 6 years. April Delaney will make the case for her candidacy tomorrow on Midday. And if you've just joined us today, my guests are Tom Schaller and Paul Waldman, the authors of a best-selling book that has attracted a lot of praise and some pointed criticism. It's called White Rural Rage, The Threat to American Democracy. To join us, we're at 410-662-8780, our email midday@wypr.org. So Tom Schaller, one of the criticisms that you have had leveled at you is the basic definition of what you mean by rural. I was interested to read that you report that only 7% of rural Americans are farmers. And I would have thought it's a lot higher. And this guy, Nick Jacobs from Colby College, and this may be a semantic difference, but he says there's a difference between rural resentment and rural rage. He says you've rebranded resentment as rage. Should that matter, the terminology that we're using in this concept or in this context?
No, we call rural resentment throughout the book. We have pled guilty already to using the term rage in the title because titles, as publishers will tell you and their marketing teams, titles with short, even one word, even one syllable word, titles tend to sell better. So think of, you know, Blink by Malcolm Gladwell. Now, we couldn't write a book called White or White Rural. We had to have a third word there. We're really talking about the sociological and political construct resentment. And in fact, if you do a word search on the text of the book, we don't use the word rage more than three or four times. But yes, it appears on the cover. It is provocative. And we cop to that, but we're talking about the same concept as Jacobs and other scholars are throughout the book. And, you know, as far as this definition of rural, the problem is there is no definition of rural. The federal government's various agencies have more than a dozen definitions. The U.S. Department of Agriculture, the USDA, can't even agree on a definition. Sometimes a lot of it's classified by counties. But even counties that some of our federal agencies classify as metro counties may have as few as 30% people who actually live in cities, which means 70% of the people even in metro designated counties, according to what's called the RUCA codes, R-U-C-A, could be from non-cities. Now, a lot of them are suburbanites, but some of them are urban people as well. So even in an urban county, there are, across all the urban counties in the country, there are literally millions of rural Americans who live there. And so one of the problems with the analyses at the county level, and actually we think Jacobs and his co-author Dan Shea do a very good job of rebuilding the counties from the census block up, and they actually establish a higher threshold. They only count counties as urban if they are 50% in terms of the urban residents or more, and we applaud them for that. But as they admit in their book, there is no uniform one standard. And we find it a little bit galling that they're asking us to both define a standard and to have one standard when the government itself can't agree. If they want to convince the agencies of the federal government to a single standard, their standard or otherwise, you know, we applaud their efforts to do so. I think it's an uphill climb. We provide a very detailed author's note at the end of the book where we say, look, there is no universal standard. When we report polls in the book, as we do, we use the metrics that each pollster uses. So sometimes pollsters classify citizens metro, non-metro in a sheer dichotomy, which is frankly oversimplifying, but we don't have any control over that. Most pollsters just trichotomize between rural, urban, and suburban. Sometimes they do that by asking people to identify themselves. We know some people misidentify where they're from. Sometimes they get their zip codes and their county codes and then organize them after the fact. We have no control over that. And as we say, we're at the mercy of the pollsters that we cite, including reputable pollsters like the Public Religion Research Institute and Pew. They don't all agree on a single standard for how to measure what is rural and what is non-rural. It's a problem. It's an intractable problem. We didn't cause it. Neither did our critics. And all you can do is try to manage it.
And Paul Waldman, when it comes to violence and the predilection for use of force and violence in the political process, and you assert that, you know, rural Americans are more inclined in that direction than urban Americans. Is the January 6th insurrection a manifestation of this rage? I mean, this is where one of the critics, this guy named Robert Pape, who is a scholar from the University of Chicago, disagreed in an article in Slate magazine where he said that most of the people involved in January 6th were from counties that Joe Biden won in the election, and they're mostly suburban and urban. They're not mostly rural. To make the claim that, you know, rural Americans are more predisposed towards violence in the political process is a really strong claim. How do you respond?
Well, the first thing to understand is that a lot of this is about kind of latent support that might or might not become important at some point in the future. Now, Pape is right that the people who actually participated and were arrested on January 6th come mostly from those kind of suburban places, in part because, you know, you needed some resources to get to January 6th. You had to have the ability to travel there, to get a hotel room. You know, that may have limited the ability of a lot of people, most people in the country, to actually go there, even if they wanted to participate. But a lot of the question comes in how are things going to play out? How did they play out this time around? And how are they going to play out next time around? You know, we have a political movement that valorizes violence on the right. We've obviously, from Trump himself, he talks all the time about, you know, I'd like to punch that guy in the face. He celebrates that idea that people you don't like should be met with violence. And we see it in all different kinds of ways. I mean, take the story of Kyle Rittenhouse. You know, the right could have reacted to that tragic event where he shot three people and killed two of them in Kenosha, Wisconsin, by saying, you know, this was a dumb kid and he should never have gone there. He was 17 years old or something like that. And it was a tragedy, but we think that that he was acting in self-defense and he shouldn't have been convicted. They could have taken that position, but instead, what did the right do with Kyle Rittenhouse? They turned him into a hero because he killed two people. He got invited to Mar-a-Lago. He got a fawning interview with Tucker Carlson. He is given standing ovations at conservative conferences all over the country. So you have a movement that is infused with a celebration of violence. And this you can see in some polls of rural people showing higher support for certain kinds of violence, but it's very difficult to really pin down. You know, you can ask somebody, well, you know, if your side doesn't win the next election, do you think that the president should be overthrown by force? And most people are not going to say yes. Very few people are going to admit to that. There are some results that show that rural people are more likely to say yes to questions like that. But even there, it's a small portion of the population at large. But that doesn't necessarily tell you how it's going to play out if we see another kind of January 6th or something that plays out more comprehensively in many more places around the country. If Donald Trump loses and there is some kind of violent movement to reverse the results of the next election, what kind of support is it going to get? What kind of tacit approval is it going to get? And where is that going to be coming from? Those are questions that are not easy to answer, especially when you're dealing with polls where, you know, someone who's on the phone, they know what the kind of socially acceptable answer to give to a question like that is. But it is something that we all need to be concerned about. Whether we're talking about rural people or suburban people or urban people, this is a movement that is saturated in a celebration of violence. And the MAGA movement has its most intense support in rural places. So it is something to be deeply, deeply concerned about.
And if I could add something real quickly here, Tom, in
sure.
A recent piece we wrote last week for The Conversation. I had to write it solo because their rule is that you have to be an academic. So I wrote on behalf of Paul and I, even though it's my byline alone. We cite two statistics. We had a limited space, 800 words, about the justification of violence. The first is from, as I mentioned before, the Public Religion and Research Institute, led by Robert P. Jones. And the question they ask is, the statement that they give is, true American patriots may have to resort to violence in order to save our country, unquote. Rural Americans support that, 26%. Suburbanites, 18%. Urbanites, 16%. So, you know, there's a difference there. Maybe people think it's qualitatively insubstantial. It is statistically significant. And as Paul said, it's a minority opinion, but look who's at the top. Rural Americans, 8 points higher than suburbanites and 10 points higher than urbanites. The second question comes from Robert Pape, Chicago C-Post, Chicago Project on Security Threats. And here's the quote there. It may be necessary at some point soon for citizens to take up arms against the government, end quote. Rural Americans agree, 35%. Suburbanites, only 25%. Urbanites, 29%. So that's two examples. And then Cal Muniz, who's been a frequent critic of ours and a fellow academic, he just published a piece in Political Behavior in October of 2023, too late for inclusion in our book, where he finds two related findings. First, he finds that rural citizens are no more likely, and maybe even slightly less likely, to support violence against their fellow citizens. We're comforted to hear that. But he finds that high resentment rural whites are more likely to support violence against the state. This strikes us as a very, very important finding in the post January 6th environment, where we watched collectively on TV as a domestic terrorist and insurrectionist attack against our public officials in our U.S. Capitol building was fomented by the incumbent president of the United States. And rural whites who have high resentment, not all rural whites, are more likely to justify state violence as a concept. That's in the research of one of our critics.
That's Tom Schaller along with Paul Waldman. They are the authors of White Rural Rage. That's the book we're talking about, The Threat to American Democracy. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. And Tom Schaller, the other claim that you make, and again, it's difficult to make claims about, you know, entire cohorts of demographic groups in a voting block or in various electoral voting blocks. But you say right at the top of the book that rural whites are uniquely hostile toward racial and religious minorities, recent immigrants, and urban residents in general. There are some, again, folks in the scholarly community that take issue with that statement. Nobody likes to be called a racist. But you also say that rural whites are the most conspiratorial cohort in the United States. To make that statement, is it a chicken and the egg thing? Is it because they have resentments? And the irony of those resentments is that many times these communities have very few immigrants. There are some. There are some black farmers, very few, but there are some. There are, the problems that they attribute to their own lives caused by people in urban areas. It's an interesting argument they're making because, you know, what's going on in these urban areas don't really affect them on a day-to-day basis. So there's an irony there. But what is your take on the racial dimension of rural America?
Well, first of all, there's two aspects to the racial dimension of rural America. One of the things that we point out throughout this book is that if resentments are born of the rural experience, resentments toward cities, resentments toward faraway people in the state legislatures, and we know that from Catherine Kramer's book, The Politics of Resentment, that rural people she interviewed are unhappy with the M&Ms, Madison County, where the state university and the state government are, and Milwaukee, the blackest county in Wisconsin. If it's true that it's just rurality and it's not race, then the experience of rural minorities, who are 24% of rural America and get not nearly that amount of attention or coverage, one out of four rural Americans is non-white. Their rural experience is the same. They're rural as well. And in fact, on every metric we could find, health and healthcare and economic metric, with the exception of COVID deaths, largely because of vaccine skepticism, and gun deaths, because rural whites have disproportionate shares of the guns in their states, on every other economic and healthcare measure, rural minorities do worse than their white neighbors in rural America, and they don't express the same resentments. On the other hand, the other definition of racism, or xenophobia, as we call it in the book, is this animosity toward people who look, think, act, pray, and live in different places from rural white Americans. Let me just give you a couple of data points. These come from the Pew Research Center's finding. Again, quotes that you agree or disagree with. Quote, the growing number of newcomers from other countries strengthens American society. 40% of rural Americans agree, but 16 points higher, suburbanites agree, 56%, and 24% higher, urbanites agree. Here's another one. Quote, it is personally very or somewhat important to live in a community that is racially and ethnically diverse. Again, rural Americans at the bottom, 52%, a majority agreeing, 59% of suburbanites and 79% of urbanites. And remember, those suburban and urbanites include some people who are polled who are rural living in suburban and urban counties. So the differences may be wider, in fact, than are reported because of the problem, not the problem, but the complication that millions of rural Americans live in suburban and urban counties, which our critics are very silent about pointing out. Lastly, on conspiracism, there's quite a few data points here, but I'll give you just the most obvious one. The 2020 election was stolen from Donald Trump. Percentage of rural Americans who agree, 47%. Suburbanites, just 30%. Urbanites, less than half, 22%. So there are conspiracist attitudes that, again, is it every rural American? No. Is it every rural white American? No. Is it exclusive to rural white Americans? No. But they're at the top. They're least likely or most likely to agree with various statements about this, our democracy, about their fellow citizenships, and about conspiracies.
It's Tom Schaller along with Paul Waldman. They are the authors of White Rural Rage, The Threat to American Democracy. And Tom, I know we need to let you go because you've got a class to teach at UMBC. So thank you for your time. And Paul, I know you're going to stick around with us until the top of the hour. So Tom, thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Thanks for inviting us, Tom. Great questions. Cheers.
I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Midday. Stay with us.
This is 88.1 WYPR.
And welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you just joined us, we're talking about a controversial new book by Tom Schaller, a political scientist on the faculty of the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, and Paul Waldman, an author, journalist, and opinion writer. It's called White Rural Rage, The Threat to American Democracy. Tom Schaller has had to leave our conversation to go teach a class at UMBC, and Paul Waldman is with us until the top of the hour. You are welcome to join us, 410-662-8780, our email midday@wipr.org. So, Paul, I do want to talk about the scope of what this means. We're going to, whatever one might believe, and you make very persuasive arguments about racial resentment and inclinations towards violence, etc. But you have a chapter in the book called The Greatest Political Hand Ever Dealt. We touched on this a little bit in the beginning, the malapportionment of the Electoral College, particularly in the Senate, with the overrepresentation of people from smaller states. I was amazed to read that of the 40 smallest states, so that's almost all states, it's just there's 10 that are bigger, of the 40 smallest states, one county in California, LA County, has more people than all of the 40 smallest states. What is the effect on democracy when that is the case?
Yeah, there are 10 million people who live in Los Angeles County. And those of us who live in states like Maryland often wonder, you know, why do there have to be two Dakotas? but, you know, we have built into the system a real preference for the state as a political entity. And the consequences of that are oftentimes just gridlock and oftentimes a real advantage given to one party or another. Now, it wasn't always to the advantage of the Republican Party, but it certainly is now. And part of the reason that's likely to continue is that red states, that many of these small, more rural states have become more and more red over time. You know, it wasn't that long ago that South Dakota had two Democratic senators, one of whom, Tom Daschle, was the leader of Democrats in the Senate. Now, it's almost impossible to imagine a Democrat winning a Senate race in South Dakota. And so you have this collection of small states, not all of which are Republican. There's a couple, Delaware, Rhode Island, that are Democratic, but most of which are heavily Republican. And that means that that the Senate in particular is much more skewed to the Republican Party. And so if you look at how many people are represented by the current members of the Senate, I did the calculations recently. It's over 50 million more Americans are represented by Democrats than represented by Republicans. And yet Democrats have only a 51-49 margin at the moment. And after this election, there's a very good chance that Republicans are going to take back control of the Senate, even if the vote totals of who's voting for Democrats and who's voting for Republicans doesn't change. Democrats basically have to run the table in order to have any chance of even getting a 50-50 control, because there's one seat, and I'm going on a little bit of a digression here, but there's one seat in West Virginia where Joe Manchin is retiring. West Virginia is one of the states that we reported from. It's very, very interesting politically, but that's going to go Republican, and Democrats have to win every other seat if they're going to retain control of the Senate. So the Senate is one way in which that happens. You also see it in the House, where there are a lot of districts that are either maybe not entirely rural, but substantially rural, and almost all of them are represented by Republicans, that give rural America kind of an extra boost in the House. And then you have at the state level, you have gerrymandering of lines that gives rural areas more influence. And you also have Republicans at the state level who are kind of trying to look for creative ways to enhance rural power. So I'll give you an example. In Missouri, the Republican Party there got kind of perturbed with their own state's voters, because they have voter initiatives in Missouri, and the Missouri electorate kept passing these rather progressive initiatives. They passed one to increase the minimum wage. They passed one to accept the expansion of Medicaid and the Affordable Care Act. They passed one to overrule the legislature's passage of a right to work law. So Missouri Republicans said, what can we do about this? And the idea they came up with was a kind of electoral college for ballot initiatives. This is now, I think, past the Missouri State House. It's going to the Missouri State Senate. And it says that not only for a ballot initiative to pass does it have to get a statewide majority, but it would also have to get a majority in at least 5 of the 8 congressional districts. And if you look at the Missouri congressional districts, it turns out that of those 8, 5 of them are substantially rural because of the way the lines have been drawn. So it effectively gives rural Missourians kind of a veto over what the rest of Missourians want to do in policy. And so that's an example of how state-level Republicans are looking around at ways to solidify their own power, to get the policy outcomes that they want. And one of the ways they do it over and over again is to boost the power of those rural people. Now, the question then leads to, what actually do rural Americans get from all this power that they have? And I don't know if you have another question you want to ask, but I can certainly talk about that, because the answer is not a whole lot.
Well, we have a listener who has on his mind the same thing I have on mine. This is Stan in Hagerstown, to talk about the cycle of despair and disillusionment. I mean, the grievances, the resentment, whatever you want to call it, that are a factor in rural life, are premised in some really difficult situations. You mentioned the lack of health care. You mentioned death rates, which are higher in rural America than they are in urban America. Also, just economically, crop prices. You talk about the crop prices between 1945 and 1970. They rose, but they shrank, actually, compared to the increase in the price of consumer goods, which went up way like 116% or something. So business has not been good for farmers for a long, long time.
Absolutely. And those problems are deep and profound. There were a few things, you know, we traveled to rural places all over the country, and there were a few things that came up again and again, whether we were talking to, you know, ex-coal miners in West Virginia, or African-Americans in North Carolina, or Latinos in Arizona. There were a few things that came up again and again. One of them is the brain drain that people, that ambitious young people graduate from high school. They look around, they say, there's not a lot of economic opportunity here. I'm going to have to go to the city. And so the best and the brightest keep leaving. And that was something people told us about, sometimes with tears in their eyes, literally, thinking about their own kids moving away, that because there just wasn't enough opportunity in their communities. That was something we heard everywhere. We heard about healthcare access everywhere, about how far you have to go to get to a hospital. There have been almost 200 rural hospitals that have closed over the last 20 years. And so these are deep and profound problems. And they do cause a lot of resentment. People feel like they and their communities have been left behind. And then you have a politics that doesn't seem to address those problems because it's been hollowed out in a lot of places. Now, people have probably heard, everyone keeps telling Democrats, oh, you have to go kind of re-engage in rural America. You got to go talk to those people. You have to be respectful. You have to show them that you understand their lives. And maybe if you kind of crawl on your knees to rural Americans in the places where you're losing badly, they might consider maybe voting for you again. Nobody takes the next step to ask Republicans, what are you doing for rural America? You're getting all the votes. You know, in a lot of rural places, every single person that that you are represented by, from, you know, U.S. Senate down through congressman, through the state legislature, all the way down to dog catcher, every single one of them is a Republican, and often a conservative Republican. And yet no one seems to ask them, what are you doing to address our lack of healthcare access? What are you doing to try to give us more economic opportunity? What are you doing about the infrastructure that we that is so poorly, is holding up so poorly? What are you doing to address these problems? And that lets Republicans off the hook because they don't have to do anything. They know they're going to get the votes. They can come in and just, you know, give people a little bit of like culture war stuff right at the end. Aren't you mad? Yeah, I'm mad. And then that's all they need to do. You know, I'll tell you one quick story. We talked to Ben Wickler, who's the chairman of the Democratic Party in Wisconsin. And he said that a couple of years ago, for the first time in a long while, Democrats put up candidates in every single district in the state for a state legislature. And he said he would get calls from some of these Democrats who are running in rural areas saying, hey, things are going great here. I don't even see my Republican opponent. He's nowhere. I'm knocking on doors every day. And I look at his my opponent's filings for the election commission. He hasn't raised any money. I am out there on the hustings. I'm talking to people. This is going to go in well. I really think I'm going to win. And then it would turn out that Democrat would lose by 30 points because the Republicans know they don't have to fight. They're going to get the votes anyway. And that leads to a system without any accountability. You need political competition to create that accountability. And so one of the things we say near the end of the book is that, you know, we're not just saying everybody in rural America should vote for Democrats. Maybe some of them should. That'd be fine. But at the very least, they should get themselves some better Republicans. They should start demanding accountability to say to them, what are you actually doing? And 4 years later, when you come back, if you haven't fulfilled the promises you made, we're going to get us somebody different. But unfortunately, that's not happening in enough places.
Yeah, you mentioned a guy named Keith Judd, who back in 2012, he paid a filing fee to get on the West Virginia Democratic primary ballot, even though he was in prison in Texas for extortion. And he beat Barack Obama in a particular county, 60-40, in Mingo County. That's all we have time for today to talk about this book, White Rural Rage, The Threat to American Democracy. The authors are Tom Schaller and Paul Waldman. Paul, thank you so much for your time. Congratulations on the book. I think it's a really persuasive and interesting read.
It's been my pleasure, Tom. Thanks a lot.
And we will post links to some of the reviews of the book on our website. Come to WIPR.org/midday. Those reviews will include links to folks who take issue with Tom Schaller and Paul Waldman about their book, White Rural Rage. That's it for us today. Coming up tomorrow, our series of conversations with the candidates continues with April Delaney. She's a candidate for House of Representatives in the 6th District Democratic Primary. And coming up next, it's Fresh Air. And stay tuned at 2 o'clock for NPR's live special coverage of the solar eclipse today. That's going to happen during Here and Now, hosted by Robin Young and Scott Tong. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us today here on Midday. Have a great day.
This is 88.1 WIPR.